All right, today's lesson is family in the 21st century. This is a more of a information dump lesson, not a lot of discussion in it, and it's not really even a Bible study as such. I'm going to pretend it is by using one or two verses at the very front. That's what preachers do when they want to do a non-Bible Bible lesson. They're like, here's a verse about something, and then they go do their lesson, and then they can pretend. I showed them that verse. So here's our verse about something. From 1 Chronicles, chapter 12, this is the story of after the civil war between Saul and David and Israel. You have all these little troops of under generals and so forth and warlords, really. And some of them had been loyal to Saul, and some of them had been loyal to David. And the battle has clearly tipped in David's favor. And so some of them, in chapter 12, start realigning themselves with David politically, and like, oh yeah, we swear allegiance to you. And the way it's described is kind of by tribe. So verse 23 says, these are the numbers of the divisions of the armed troops who came to David in Hebron to turn the kingdom of Saul over to him according to the word of the Lord. And then in reference to one specific group, there's kind of this funny phrase of Issachar, men who had understanding of the times, to know what Israel ought to do, 200 chiefs and all their kinsmen under their command. The expression, who had understanding of the times, doesn't really say they were deeply morally motivated. It was more like, yeah, we're not dumb, we watch the news. We know what's going on, and if our people have any future, we're gonna have to adjust to this new circumstance. So we were really loyal to Saul yesterday. We're going to be really loyal to David today. It's not an especially heroic moment, but this passage gets yanked out of context for sermons, like I'm going to do now, to say, like, there is some value, some practical wisdom of knowing what's going on in the world. Where are we? What is our setting? I can take you to pulpits around the country that are preaching and addressing issues that haven't existed for 60 or 70 years. And while that's all very good, well and good and interesting, it's not really helpful for the current state of things. And so the great German theologian Karl Barth said, before Billy Graham said it, by the way, Karl Barth said, a pastor is a man with a Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other. Because you kind of have to know what's going on out there to be able to connect the dots. So today, we're going to have our understanding the times talk and just try to see if we can get some kind of picture of the state of the world that we're in terms of family. I'm not going to do Ukrainian politics, just in terms of family, where are we at? It's kind of difficult, not kind of, especially difficult to get good family statistics. Good statistics in general are hard to get. So when I went back, I'd written this lesson almost a decade ago. Yep, over a decade ago, and I went back and reviewed it, so all the statistics were from the year 2000, and I gave the lesson in 2010, so they were already 10 years old when I gave them, so I've updated them with now new 10-year-old statistics from 2012, right, which will now be 20 years old 10 years from now when I look back at this lesson. But it's hard to get really up-to-date material on statistically where our families, we just kind of get a general idea of, in the last decade or so, trends up or trends down, and where do we stand? And we're going to try to look at that and just get an idea of what it tells us. Also of note, the last 2 years have been especially hard on statisticians to figure out what are families. There's some anecdotal evidence that marriages may be in trouble because everyone had to live with their spouse for 2 years in quarantine. And there is some anecdotal evidence that divorce rates may be up a little bit, but then there's some also evidence that maybe it's not. Maybe families found out time together was wonderful and they all love each other. Who knows? So we'll see when I do this lesson 10 years from now, like, how did COVID affect the American family? That's probably not going to be in this data, but it's something I'm curious about. Okay, what do we know, more or less? I mentioned this last week a little bit. For the first time in American history, about 2016 actually, the number of married adults in American culture hit 50%, down from, say, 1960, it was 72%. And then it fell a little bit after that, too. For the first time in American history, the majority of adults are not married. Now, it's only like 51, 49%. It's not, a staggering number. But that is an interesting shift about what is commonplace in our culture. What's expected of the adult trajectory, right? Do you go get a job, leave home, get married, have kids? Like, what does that story, what adults think they're supposed to do? Well, that story is sometimes reflected in the results. And the story has shifted somewhat, where marriage is not necessarily a staple of those expectations. People aren't necessarily against it. You don't have like anti-marriage protests out there or anything. It just, kind of 50-50 is actually a great number. It's like, take it or leave it is kind of the American position on marriage in general.
A stat that goes really well with that is actually, this is a newer stat, it's 2019, just like
Yay.
the average age for an American to get married is 30 for females and 32 for men.
30 and 32. Interesting. So,
Yep,
like,
that's gone up.
from, you take a silly example, but like, colonial era, where you turn 12 and it's like, time for you to find a wife, really early in life, to now more like 32.
Yeah, because that says divorce rates, women aged 15 and older.
Yeah, isn't that funny? Like, there's a whole lot of divorced women at 15. Yeah. That's kind of funny, isn't it? I always want to take these statisticians aside and say, exactly how are you asking that question? But the point in this second chart, the dark blue is 2019, light blue is 2009. So just in 10 years, marriage rates and then divorce rates both fell. What you mentioned last week is kind of interesting. Back in the 90s, people thought like divorce was ramping up and it was just going to keep going up and up and up, and everyone would have like 15 divorces and 16 marriages. And actually, it hasn't. With the decrease in the number of marriages, also the decrease in divorce. Like, just less people just aren't getting married, and they aren't getting divorced, and they don't care. So it's kind of a shift that was not expected in the 90s when divorce rates were spiking. Not saying that's necessarily a good thing, but with this number coming down, so did that number. Why do people get married? Before I show you the chart, if you had to guess, why do people get married? What are the top reasons?
Free house.
Free housing. Move out of my parents' basement. Yeah.
That tax write-off.
Financial reasons is on the list. Yep.
Love.
Love. Look at you. Romantic. And Blake, your answer? Not love, but. Any others come to mind?
Get out of a bad situation.
Get out of a bad situation. Okay. Societal expectations.
Family obligations.
Family
Family
obligations.
Expectations.
Shotgun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dad's gun. Yeah. Okay.
Dad's gun.
Here's the way they were ranked, and you could pick more than one, so it doesn't add up to 100, of course. Carla, good job.
Yay, Carla.
You remember last week we talked about the significance of love in American culture? It's still kind of the prevailing narrative behind marriage, which is also interesting. For what it's worth, I'll just throw this out there and you can throw rocks at me. That's not necessarily the way the Bible talks about getting married. Like, there aren't a lot of romantic Bible passage about marriage. It's more about like structure and commitment and oaths and covenants and societal expectation. I mean, like, that's it. There's not a lot of romance. It's not against romance. It's just not the focal point. For us, it's kind of like the whole ball of wax, right?
Read the Song of Solomon. You'll hear about the romance.
Yeah, the romance is in Song of Solomon. The rest of the, not so much. Which is, the struggle is that if we identify love as the primary meaning of marriage, and we think love is a mood that I sometimes have and sometimes don't,
kind of explains the divorce rate.
Kind of explains the divorce rate, right? Mm-hmm. What if I fall into love, I can fall out of love. And if my marriage is based on love, and I haven't got any of that today, I should get out of it. See? And I should go find the next person I love.
It seems like it matters how you define love.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you're leading us there as a good teacher. Oh, sorry.
If you go listen to the podcast, No, that's exactly it. Like, that's exactly it, is if how you define love. If it's a mood, then your marriage is as flaky as your mood. It's going to depend on how much coffee I've had, whether I'm going to get divorced today or not, which is why there is always coffee at my house. But second was making a lifelong commitment, which I thought was kind of interesting. The desire to make a lifelong commitment. That one's kind of reassuring to me that people still care about that one. It's interesting. Sometimes we'll talk to folks about marriage and they'll say, I don't know, we're already in a committed relationship. We live together. We've done, why do we need to get married? And then others will say, we're getting married because we want to make that commitment. And so that's an interesting discussion. Companionship. A lot of people are lonely out there. Marriage is, we hope, a solution to that. Having children, 49%. I'm curious about how that one was worded, actually. Is it because we're having children or because we want to have children?
Yeah.
But they didn't tell us. A relationship recognized in a religious ceremony. That's a dad with a shotgun, maybe. we're religious and we've been told we need to get married, so okay. Financial stability. And then legal rights and benefits were the last two, but they did make the list. Yeah. It's kind of interesting.
I wonder, when was this question asked? Were these people already married, or have they been married for 2 years? Because they've...
Yeah, it's a good question.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I'll ask Pew Research Center what they did.
It also changes if the question changes from get married to be married. So why be married? And so what you're measuring here is a short-term impact of decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, why'd you get married?
So the idea of why be married, I think the Bible actually speaks to how to be married more than why to get married.
Yeah.
And so the methodology here is having children in that context is there's a child at play.
Yeah.
And so that influences their decision already. So this is a short-term poll speaking to long-term consequences, which makes it questionable in terms
yes.
of validity.
Yes. I'm going to use it anyway.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a pretty chart. Come on, Mark.
I love it. The pictures are and Carla was right.
What about, and you can probably guess this one, what we're going to politely call unmarried cohabitation. People living together romantically but not married. If you had to guess that number up or down in the last several decades. Yeah, that was not hard. So between 1960 and 1998, the number went up by close to 1,000%. So up a bit is the way we'd say that. And that was all the way up to the sunny days of 1998. Worth noting, so far as anyone can tell, there's no evidence that shows cohabitation leads to lower divorce rates. So the excuse that we often get in like premarital counseling or something is, well, we feel like we need to figure out if we can stay together, and then we'll get married after we've, you know, shown that we're compatible or whatever. There's no indication that one is connected to the other. You're just as likely to get divorced if you live together 7 years before your marriage or none. It has no impact whatsoever. Because of the reason we discussed last week, you change anyway. So even if you find somebody you're really compatible with, you're going to be a different person a few years down the road. There is some evidence that cohabitation even leads to higher divorce rates. Not sure why that is, but it's curious. Here's a quote from that study. What can be said is that the research does not provide consistent evidence that cohabitation helps couples prepare for marriage. Like, there's just no data you can actually point to that says that was a good idea. And there's not a lot saying it's a bad idea. That would be a different question. But it's just, it's not the weird justification that it's actually helping us is no, not really. It's not doing much for us. In addition to half of the U.S. adults who are married, about 7% were cohabitating in 2016. I think that's wrong. I think it's much higher than that. But maybe we don't tell on ourselves on that one. I don't know. And also, you know, if I just have a toothbrush there, am I cohabitating? I don't know. It's a hard question to actually get data on. The number of Americans living with an unmarried partner reached about 18 million in 2016, which was up 29% from 2007. So again, up is the direction. Roughly half of cohabitors, I like cohabitators, that would be better, are younger than 35, but cohabitation is also rising most quickly among Americans age 50 and older.
Mm-hmm.
Boomers shacking up, how about that? Shame your grandparents.
I was going to say, I think it's after that.
Yep.
I think that statistic is probably has to do with a second marriage or a second relationship.
Wait until the alimony's finished.
Yes.
Yeah. In terms of remarriage, in 2013, 23% of married people had been married before. It was 13% in 1960. So again, I think if you ask anybody in the 90s, they would say that number is going to be like 100%. You know, everybody's going to have 10 marriages. And it went up, but not as dramatically as people thought, because we just lost faith in the institution of marriage more generally. So that's an interesting number. Let's see. What about children? Marriage is not specifically linked to having children in modern thought. If you listen to, pull out the Book of Common Prayer and you read the marriage ceremony, it has like a whole paragraph where the minister is supposed to say, "And if it be thy will, O Lord, bless this family with the heritage of children, that they may range and the whatever, whatever."
Your dad did.
Dad spelled it out. He performed our wedding and said, "And they will have grandchildren."
But, whoa.
Thank you, meant children. "They will give me grandchildren." And that was in the ceremony. We were commanded. So did our best. But yeah, it's not strongly linked in people's minds with having children necessarily. And in general, fertility rates are quite a lot down. We're having less kids. That's, again, not a surprise from odd to me. And I don't know how to explain it. You might think when times are easy, you had less kids. And when times are hard, you had more kids. But it was like pioneer families having 19 kids with a mortality rate of 7 apiece. And then the modern family, where life is surprisingly easy but busy, where we actually say, well, we'd like, 2 is plenty. You know, it's not, or 2.3 or whatever the magic number is. So the fertility rate's quite a lot down over the last few decades and don't seem to be resurfacing. There is a demographic of the American population that has a much higher fertility rate. Anyone care to guess? Hispanics. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Catholic, Roman Catholic, Hispanic immigrants have much larger families. And so they're actually kind of waiting the trend. If it was just among kind of your white middle class families, the number would actually be a lot lower. But Hispanic Catholic families have a lot more kids.
I was going to say Amish.
Amish, yeah, well, they don't answer the phone when the census taker calls.
They weren't available to answer.
Not available.
No.
View of same-sex marriage in 2007. Americans opposed legalizing same-sex marriage by a margin of 54 to 37. 10 years later, 62% favor it, 32% oppose it. That's like a complete reversal in a 10-year span. Even more dramatic if you compare it to 1990s. Mid-1990s, you had DOMA, Defense of Marriage Act, I think it was called. And like you had a bipartisan, I think there was one guy in all of Congress who voted against it. It was nearly unanimous, both parties. They couldn't sign up fast enough to prove they were, you know, pro-traditional marriage. And then to demonstrate that it was more or less because that's where the polls were. Now, you know, the politicians kind of reflect the mood of the country on that. So that's just, again, today I'm not preaching for and against stuff. I'm just talking statistics, but that is a pretty dramatic reversal in opinion.
Love is love.
We talked about love is love last week. Yeah, it's kind of just the philosophy. And it's also generationally skewed. If you're in Gen Z, you're much higher to have a positive rating, favorability of same-sex marriages and unions. If you're a boomer or older, you're much less likely. And demographics are destiny. So that number is telling us something that is likely to impact you and your kids for years to come.
But in the boomer's defense, if you're a boomer, you're against most things in general.
Yeah, you're against everything if you're a boomer. So that's, you know, get off my yard. That's right.
You're going to make a great boomer.
I'm going to be a great boomer. I'm looking forward to day when I could be the cranky old man. I was born for that.
The day that you can be?
The day when it's expected.
Yes. When we're like, oh, he's just holding great. It's fine. Yeah, it's really, no big deal. Now it's like, you're a jerk.
Yeah. Here's one that I thought was interesting that may not interest other people as much, but I think fascinating because of what it says about our culture. What things do you worry about in a marriage of picking out a spouse? Who do you want your kids to marry? Kind of questions. In the 1960s, the question would have been, what religion are they? And by religion, we meant denominational affiliation.
Yeah,
We want a Baptist to marry a Methodist, Baptist, Methodist marry Methodist, Episcopalians marry Episcopalians, don't marry Jewish people. Like, those were the kind of strict structures of that society. And then over time is like, okay, well, marry a Christian, you know, vaguely, you know, that's okay, it's good. Today, about 4 in 10 Americans who have married since 2010 have a spouse who is a different religious group, compared with only 19% before 1960. But when it comes to politics, 77% of both Republicans and Democrats are married or living with a partner set of their spouse of the same party.
I wonder if it started that way.
Isn't that interesting? Like, we, and I've heard this anecdotally too, like, I'm not really worried about the person my kid brings home religiously, but I hope it's not a Republican, you know, or I hope it's not a Democrat, or I hope, you know, it's like, you know, like,
a libertarian,
you know, don't bring home one of those people. Not someone too woke or not woke enough. Like, we're more concerned about political affiliation than religion, which to me tells me just the insignificance of religion in modern American life, that it's just not on our radar very much. We don't feel like it should matter. And as a minister, I'm like, yeah, you know, I don't want to go back to the days where it's like we're skeptical of the Methodists because they go to a different church. That said, I am bothered by the idea that religion has no consequence for who you want to spend the rest of your life with. That's not a good thing either, right? You might want to share some values of some kind somewhere. And why do Republican or Democrat have all the cards on their side of the table on that? That bothers me a lot.
Does that say something further to the distractedness of the current generations that we're not paying attention to that?
Yeah.
Just, well, that's not the same measurement. Mm-hmm. Republicans and Democrats are the religion of today.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
That,
yeah.
It's the same measurement.
That's the identity creating institution.
And 1960 is a deliberate timeline with the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah.
With the Civil Rights Act, marriage was no longer ecumenical. It was a relationship with the state.
Yeah.
And since then, this is not an accident.
No.
At all.
No.
And so it's what religion, as in what political party you vote.
Well,
so glad you said all that, because I keep telling myself, don't rant about your favorite topics. But Mark's doing it, so I can just be like, I just showed statistics, and then Mark said things.
It's almost like when they get married, they're like, wait, we got to pull God, preach, or something in this. When they pass, it's that same thing. So obviously, it's on everyone's radar in some sort of fashion of minister, church.
Like, I'm depressed
God.
Because it feels like they don't know where to go for that, but I'm thrilled and hopeful that there's still this impulse in human life. It's like, there should be something transcendent about a funeral, about a wedding. I don't even know what it is anymore, but I know it should be there. And that gives me hope of, like, there is this yearning for that. Percentages of live births that were to unmarried women, just quickly. Yeah, higher for most categories. Not a lot of shock there. Why does that matter? We're not trying to pour cold water on single parents, but statistically, we also know percentages of children under age 16, age 18 with a single parent by your race, that number's gone up quite a lot. And with that comes this other startling realization that children in single parent families are 2 to 3 times more likely to have what's called a negative life outcome, where it just statistically, there's trouble there. So again, we're not trying to say shame on you, single parents, by any stretch, but there is a statistical reality that you connect outcomes to family stability, and it does have an impact. Okay, so I give you all those statistics not to be the get off my yard guy, not even to depress you. I think every one of those has opportunities built into it, right? Every obstacle, but we need to be aware of what are the challenges that we're currently facing. Not what were our parents' challenges, what are ours, and then how do we reckon with those? I'm going to make my quick list of things that I think would help, and then I'll stop and let you guys comment as you see fit.
To nail down.
Like that.
Yeah.
That's the thing about.
Because we are a member of a congregation, and we're not as readily exposed to the out there in this.
Too many variables to have an actualized scientific.
So remember
word there, like.
The whole I think in statistics it's called we called it the Monte Carlo theorem, which was probably just a goofy name for it. But the principle is, let's say there's a 75% chance that you, or let's say it even, there's a 10% chance that this slot machine will pay out. Okay. You've done it 9 times and haven't won. Statistically, what's the odds that it will pay out on the 10th time? It's still 10%. Like every individual instance stands by itself. If you flip a quarter 1,000,000 times, 1,000,001 is still 50-50. Now the aggregate, like over the mass, you'll see trends and it should come out to this or that. But any individual instance is what it is. In family statistics, it's the same way. In aggregate, you pick every single family in the country. This is what it seems to be the trend. Any individual single parent, any individual family can break that trend.
Well, especially because it's not factoring in faith in God.
Yeah, so there's a lot of there are redeeming qualities that can change this. My dad's mom died when he was 8, and his dad went to prison. Mm-hmm. He became a preacher. Statistically, that does not make a lot of sense, right? But it's what he did. So like any individual story can come out differently, and churches can make those stories come out differently, especially. But just in terms of what can we expect from these trends, well, it ain't pretty, right? Eventually, you pull that lever enough times, Russian roulette ends one way if you keep playing, right? It's the way it works. So what kind of responses can we have? Invest in your own marriage. There's exactly one marriage that you have more control over than any other. I cannot fix all the others. I can't go to the Supreme Court and tell them how I want them to rule on this thing or that thing. I can't do any of those things. There's exactly one marriage that I can invest in and make a difference in more than any other, and it's mine. So do that, step one, and there'll be one less troublesome marriage, you know, on the statistics. Invest in your own. Speak well of marriage. It's really easy to do a comedy special entirely based on how dumb marriage is, right? It's like there's a lot of built-in jokes.
Like what?
No. Woo, let me tell you. Yeah. For example, Mark, tell us. No, I mean, it's really easy to be cynical about marriage, right? It's not hard. It's self-fulfilling prophecy. If we only speak poorly of marriage, marriage becomes a poor thing, right? So say nice things about it would be one thing. Provide real-life diverse models of what marriage can be. In a church setting, I don't think it's helpful to only look at one couple and say, like, that's the perfect white picket fence marriage and everyone should be like that. There's going to be a variety of ways that people make marriage work, and we can celebrate all of them. They will be different. Every relationship, it turns out, will be different. But within the confines of, there are some God-given boundaries to what marriage is, but within those hedges, there's quite a lot of room for individual diversity of things people walk through and work through. Number 5, start marriage education earlier and continue it longer. And premarital counseling should be an absolute requirement. It is for me. If you want me to perform your wedding, you have to get some.
Marriage education.
Just talking about, with people who are not considering marriage even, young people like talk about what marriage is. It would be useful. I'm not saying youth ministers should spend all their time talking about marriage, but before you get there, it would be nice to have some baseline discussion, both in the family setting and the church setting, of what marriage is about and its significance.
Well, that might break the cycle of seeing something bad and deciding that that's not for you. You're never going to get married if you have more discussion of it.
I remember back to high school days, the reason you get married is so you can have sex and that's it. Like that's it.
Yeah.
That's all the discussion they had about what marriage is.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of think that the movement away from generational families, when you grew up, when grandma and grandpa lived in the in-law suite off the back of your house, and aunt and uncle were just across the way, and it was almost built into life. But
now it's isolated.
That's kind
now of it's isolated.
Yeah.
Yep, more isolation.
Yep.
And another thing I'll just point on this, the marriage education within your home, people have different opinion of this, but Ben and I, when we do have arguments, we do that in front of our kids to try to show them what that looks like. We've had to have a talk with Lucas because he young was very concerned that every time we fought, we get a divorce, because that's what his friends were telling him. That when my parents, they fought all the time and then they got divorced. So we have just tried with our boys to, you know, they can hear that what's going on, kind of back and forth, nothing, you know, outlandish. But then we go to them and talk to them afterwards and say, hey, I know that was a lot going on, a lot of adult discussion. You got any questions? Your dad and I are trying to work through something, and this is how you do that. And it's communication. Sometimes communication looks ugly and frustrating, but you got to do it. And we don't want you guys to be the ones sitting on our couch saying we never fought in our marriage, because we've had couples do that, and that tells us you weren't fighting for your marriage. If you've never had an argument, if you've never gone to bat about something with your spouse, you're not really fighting for your marriage. You're just coasting along. And so we would just want to impart that to Lucas anyway.
And that is all. I went long last time, so I have to quit on time this time. Anyway, thank you guys. Next week, more of that sort of thing. Appreciate your comments. We'll have the edited version online for you to review at some other day. It'll be 30 seconds long.